Good afternoon, everybody. I want to again welcome everybody, people sitting for the weekend, and guests also. And like I was trying to say last night, I want to invite each of us to really welcome all of us, all of ourselves here. I really appreciated Norman's talk this morning about the process of Zazen. And it would be easy to think that Zen, because of something gets transmitted from sort of the style and the format, the unsentimental style, as he mentioned. It may make it look like we should only bring a certain version of ourself to Sesshin, to the retreat, to the Zendo. Whatever version of you think that is. And all the other versions and voices should be left at home. And if they refuse to stay home, they should be repressed, tied up, gagged. And we can't help but do that, so. But little by little, I think we see it. It just creates more suffering, right? To try to repress that voice of anger, that voice of judgment, that voice of self-criticism, that voice of excitement, that voice of when's it going to get better, that voice of whatever it is. These many different versions of ourself that are with us all the time. And one of the great advantages of the Zen retreat life is that we can't ignore them. Here they are. We can't get busy or engage in some other activity. We can only just be here. And so I wanted to add a thought to Norman's thoughts about Zazen. Maybe it's not just Zazen per se, but this whole container of community, practice, schedule, patterns, life. It's maybe the reason why we have these complicated ways of eating and standing and walking, is to hold us in a certain position. So that we can see who we are in all of its aspects. And this made me think of a poem that's often read in mindfulness classes, and you know I do that kind of thing a lot. So I've shared this poem before, probably. I'll share it again. It's a version of Rumi. The poem was named The Guest House. I don't know if Rumi had a particular poem called that or if it was just a section of a text that the translator called that. So this question of how we meet these different selves, these different voices, how do we greet them when they show up? So the text says, "This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture still. Treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door, laughing, and invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond." So it's such an amazing privilege to get to sit in the Dokusan and try do that practice, you know, attempt to do that practice of sitting in the seat and responding, having conversations. And what I've noticed is that most of us, our default response is not to welcome these things. And when our furniture is being crushed, usually what we want help with is repair and ejection of these crushing forces. We're not usually asking our teachers, I wonder what the new delight's going to be. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. She may be clearing you out for some new delight. So it's also sort of a statement of very radical acceptance. And we know that any statement strongly in one direction includes many other aspects. Maybe there are times when you should shut the door. Maybe there are times when you should escort them out the back. So you may have heard this poem before, but maybe you haven't heard this response poem. It's by a woman named Amy Newell. Not so famous person, but I can tell that she really practiced with this poem. So again, this question, how do we greet these voices? Do we control them? Do we manipulate them? Do we accept them? Do we reject them? Do we seek strategies for managing them? So here's what Amy Newell said about all this. Welcome all the visitors, you say. Do not put bars on the windows or locks on the doors. Do not close up the chimney flue. Duct tape and plastic sheeting will not keep these visitors at bay. They will pound on the doors. They will break your windows. They'll breach the barricades. They'll storm the beach. Swarm in like ants through the cracks. They will leak in like water through the walls and creep like mice and curl like smoke and crack like ice against the window glass. Keep them out. It can't be done. Don't try. Welcome all the visitors. Fine. There's all kinds of ways of welcoming, however. I do not have to throw a house party. I will not post flyers. There will be no open bar. No one will get drunk and lock themselves in the bathroom. No one will break the furniture, grind chips into the rug, or throw anyone else into the pool. No one will lose an earring in the couch. I do not have to run a guest house. There will be no crackling fire and no easy chairs. I will not serve tea to the visitors. I will not dispense ginger snaps and ask my guests about themselves. Did my mother send you? This is a question she's not going to ask. Why must you plague me? Why not stay a while longer? Who are you, really? If I must welcome, and I am convinced I must, let me build a great hall to receive my guests, like a Greek temple. Let it be open on all sides. Let it be wide and bright and empty. Let it have a marble floor, beautiful and cold and hard. So I noticed that I was a little bit late a few times today. And I was thinking about what, again, another so many ways that this container is useful for us to see ourselves. And I was trying to notice what were the factors, what were the choices, what was the feeling of being late, you know, to the Zendo, slipping at the last second, which actually means late. One thing I noticed was a very strong element of like greed and desire. I just wanted those few more minutes at home early this morning, where I was resting this afternoon. I will not admit that it was a coffee shop. So I was sort of holding on tight to something. And a sort of lack of generosity, a forgetting that when I come to the Zendo early, there's this amazing, you know, possibility of giving to others through my presence, stable in my seat. And I noticed that when I did slip in at the last moment, it was this feeling of agitation and not really being here and wondering who noticed and wondering what's going to happen and wondering what people now think of me. So I noticed this being late is very self-focused, very self-centered, and very familiar habit energy. And I was thinking about some research I read recently. I'm getting interested in things like compassion and positive emotions. I'm reading psychology studies and doing some work with a group out of Stanford about all this. How can we cultivate compassion for ourselves and for others? And some of the research that I've read recently is about this question of changing habits. And it seems to be there's more or less three choices, more or less, in responding to something that I do not like in myself. The first is self-criticism. Do you do this? Oh, I should, you know, terrible, I should know better, right? You know, I'm a you know, such and so is my role in a such and so, you know, training. I couldn't, this is awful. What a schmuck I am. And there's very strong research that putting energy into self-criticism effectively ensures that you will do that thing again. Very, very compelling evidence. They have different ways of measuring how people respond to things and asking them about their self-talk. It seems to be that a strong self-criticism sets up such a powerful and compelling feeling in the body and creates a kind of a feedback loop. You say to yourself something like, oh, I was late again. Terrible. And I'm never going to break this habit. More evidence that I'm right, that I can't do it. And then you're late again, you repeat, right? That's one possibility. It doesn't seem to help. The second possibility seems to be self-esteem. Do you remember the self-esteem movement? Mm-hmm. You're better than this. I know that you can do better. Think of all the advantages you have. Think of all the possibilities in life. This turns out to not really work any better than self-criticism, interestingly. And the third possibility turns out to be self-compassion, self-compassion. And self-compassion turns out to have three elements. So a message of self-compassion for myself might be something like, I feel the discomfort and the greediness, you know, the clinging in that came with being late like this. Many people are challenged by this feeling. Not just me, very common among human beings. And I forgive myself. I'm doing my best, I'll try to do better. I don't need to beat myself up. I can be kind. So here's an example of that research that's kind of interesting. So they gave a bunch of undergraduates a really hard math test. A math test that they were guaranteed to fail at. They did this at Berkeley with undergraduates. And then after they failed at the math test, they gave each person one of two messages. This is comparing self-esteem and self-compassion. The self-compassion message emphasized 3 points, which I just modeled. One is common humanity, a sense of common humanity, the universalness of our challenges, our problems, our hang-ups. Not just me, universal. A second is kindness, self-kindness. And a third is mindfulness, actually. Actually feeling the feeling, moment by moment, of how that experience was. So after the undergraduates failed, the self-kindness message, or self-compassion message, was something like, many people have trouble with these kind of tests. Don't be too hard on yourself. And how are you feeling right now? And they had a little dialogue about how the person was feeling to encourage them to actually feel it. The self-esteem message was much shorter. It was something like, don't worry, you'll do better next time. You must be really smart because you got into Berkeley. Right? And we say those kind of things to each other, right? Oh, no, don't worry. You're smart, you're good, you know. It'll be better. But this self-esteem message doesn't really encourage the mindful awareness and doesn't really encourage kindness, really. And then they gave him another hard test. And the kids who got the self-compassion message did significantly better on the second test. So anyway, I thought you'd enjoy a little science break. There are many studies like that. They mostly involve tricking the subjects. They're pretty fun to read about. This is a simple word. Oftentimes they have more elaborate ones where there's confederates of the researchers who are posing as research subjects and saying things, you know, whispering in the ears of the actual research subjects to influence them. So how to respond to these many voices? I am finding this idea of self-compassion actually quite helpful. I was resistant to it, you know. Yet another thing to learn. But those 3 points are useful. The sense of common humanity, just like me, you know, just like me. Other people are late, uptight, angry, judgmental, you know, impatient, wishing things were different. Just like me, common humanity. And that we can actually bring up kindness, that we can cultivate this in our hearts. And that, of course, we're already doing pretty good, I hope, on mindful awareness, since we're sitting here hour after hour watching each moment. So that should help. So Zen, on the one hand, seems to be very practical, you know, a little scientific even. Fits into these scientific models. Psychologically beneficial. If we do meditation, we'll improve. We'll calm down a little bit. We'll see our patterns and maybe see right through them one day. But we'll at least be a little more grounded, a little more clear, a little more self-aware, a little less triggered if we practice meditation. Do you agree with those statements? Is that why you're here? No? And probably we wouldn't be here if we didn't have some belief like that, you know. If our belief was the opposite, you know, the meditation's just going to make me more crazy, we probably wouldn't come. I think this is all true as far as it goes. But it's only one part of our rich heritage from our Buddhist ancestors over all those centuries. I think there are other parts of our practice, and Norman was mentioning this too, and I'll just use different words. Other aspects of our practice that are just as important, that aren't as apparent, that aren't as sensible, that don't make quite as much sense in that A, then B, then C kind of way that our mind would like things to be reduced to. And we have suggestions about this implanted in our liturgy. Have you noticed that? The liturgy doesn't always make total sense. Maybe you've noticed that. And that's kind of bonk, bonk, bonk way. And this morning, we chanted in Japanese, I guess, but we chanted the Heart Sutra. That great pithy text on emptiness, which is strangely popular, you know, worldwide, especially at Zen centers, but also at many other Mahayana centers. And most, you know, well-read members of non-Mahayana schools at least are familiar, you know, are familiar with the Heart Sutra, very central. And it does not really seem to celebrate self-improvement. Does not really seem to celebrate being smarter or better or even wiser. It seems to celebrate some kind of freedom. Some kind of freedom that is pointed to with negation in a confusing and interesting way, but there's a feeling to it, don't you think? You chanted that text for a while. Some kind of freedom in the senses. Some kind of freedom in the mind. Some kind of freedom even in suffering. And some kind of freedom from turning our Zen practice into a big project. Which it is. Here you are. Another sesshin, continuing the project. You ever notice that line in there? It says, nothing to attain. So that would seem to argue against Zazen providing us with all those nice things. Nothing to attain. We don't always listen to that part. That's a nice line, and I would now like to attain some peace. But then it suggests the result from this non-attainment. With nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on prajna paramita, and thus the mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. So it's one of those many voices, a voice of fear. If you let that crowd of sorrows and joys into your guest house. This text seems to be saying there's a kind of not attaining anything, and somehow there's no fear. So without attaining safety, without attaining better psychological functioning, without attaining a better understanding, it doesn't seem to be just saying a better relationship with fear. It seems to be saying no fear. And not like we had fear and then it went away. No fear, and there never was any fear. Does Zazen help us see our fear? Does Zazen actually allow us to feel fear? Are you able to access this right now? If you feel into your body, into your belly, into your breathing, into your heart, is there fear there? What is fear exactly? So I think this is an important question. Is our practice something that leads to something? Or is it radically not that? And then maybe you noticed after the Heart Sutra, we chant a text in a totally different, with a totally different flavor. This is very deliberate. An enthusiastic dedication to prajna paramita embodied as a female bodhisattva, as a goddess. Homage to the perfection of wisdom, the lovely, the holy. Do you enjoy that chant? This is a nice phrase. You can just breathe with that phrase. Homage to the perfection of wisdom, the lovely, the holy. Homage to the perfection of wisdom, the lovely, the holy. Breathe with that. Prajnaparamita is also the subject of the Heart Sutra, so such a different expression of it. Wisdom beyond wisdom. The wisdom that knows there is no wisdom, no fixed idea of a wise something, wise people who have that wise something, and so on. A wisdom that isn't hindered by ideas and concepts, including like the idea of wisdom, right? So they had to add those funny modifier words. And paramita, it's funny, you know, it's one of those where in the tradition there's all these spurious etymologies. People make up all kinds of stuff about what it means. Because in a way it doesn't mean anything, right? Wisdom that's beyond itself somehow. The little verse that we chant is actually a somewhat edited and tidied up version of the first section of chapter 7 in the Prajnaparamita Sutra in 8,000 lines, which we studied last October, but I think we didn't study that chapter. Is that right? Is this not familiar?
We did that.
Did we? Okay, we looked at it a little bit. So I thought it would be fun to appreciate that for the first time or again. And it kind of fits into a project that we've been doing here in Bellingham before the practice period. We've been starting to do a series of talks with all of our different teachers participating, exploring the different texts in our chant books. Where do these texts come from? How might they be useful for practice? So I thought it'd be fun to hear in its entirety that section of the Prajnaparamita Sutra in 8,000 lines. It's actually an excerpt of a dialogue. A disciple of the Buddha named Shariputra is talking to the Buddha about how awesome this practice is. Shariputra says, "The perfection of wisdom, O Buddha, is the accomplishment of the cognition of all knowing. The perfection of wisdom is that state of all knowledge." The Buddha says, "So it is, Shariputra, as you say," kind of encouraging him, "go on, you know." And then Shariputra really gets into it. "The perfection of wisdom gives light, O Lord." This is Edward Kahn's translation from the 60s, so he uses "O Lord" for the Buddha. I'll leave it in. "The perfection of wisdom gives light, O Lord. I pay homage to the perfection of wisdom. She is worthy of homage. She is unstained. The entire world cannot stain her. She is a source of light, and from everyone in the triple world she removes darkness and leads away from the blinding darkness caused by defilements and by wrong views. In her we can find shelter in her. Most excellent are her works. She makes us seek the safety of the wings of enlightenment. She brings light to the blind. She brings light so that all fear and distress may be forsaken. She has gained the five eyes, and she knows the path to all beings. She herself is an organ of vision. She disperses the gloom and darkness of delusion. She does nothing about all dharmas. She guides to the path those who have strayed onto a bad road. She is identical with all knowledge. She never produces any dharma because she has forsaken the residues relating to both kinds of coverings, those produced by defilements and those produced by the cognizable. She does not stop any dharma. Herself unstopped and unproduced is the perfection of wisdom. She is the mother of the bodhisattvas on account of the emptiness of own mark, and as the donor of the jewel of all the Buddha dharmas, she brings about the 10 powers of a Buddha. She cannot be crushed. She protects the unprotected with the help of the 4 grounds of self-confidence. She is the antidote to birth and death. antidote. She has a clear knowledge of the own being of all dharmas, for she does not stray away from it. The perfection of wisdom of the Buddhas, the Lords, sets in motion the wheel of the Dharma. When I first was chanting it, the Lords was still in there, so I almost always say it when we chant it. The perfection of wisdom of the Buddhas, the Lords, sets in motion the wheel of Dharma. Anyway, it's always in my mind. So how would you make sense of these somewhat divergent views of practice? A doing of practice? We do zazen. We sit down. As Norma was saying, we have to make an effort. It requires discipline. We can't just hang around. Appreciated the encouragement to those of us who have been at it for a while. Don't just hang around. There's a doing side of all this. But the power of Prajnaparamita doesn't seem to be about just doing anything. It says very spectacularly that she does nothing. She does nothing about all dharmas. Dharmas being experiences, teachings, all of it. Life. She does nothing about life. What are you doing about your life? Nothing. But this enables her to be a guide and a refuge and a source of healing and love. And on the one hand, our doing of practice is essential. We need our time on the cushion, lots of it. Time to unbend, to settle, to soften. But just sitting there won't do it either. Our sitting needs to be wise sitting, skillful practice, curious about our patterns, our energies, seeking advice from friends and teachers, guiding ourself and being guided by others, guided by teachings as well. So it seems we actually need to do all this. On the other hand, there's nothing to do. And the non-doing of Prajnaparamita is so graceful, so free, so full of ease. She's doing her good works for all beings, it's implied, without any idea of there being beings, without any idea of her being a helper. So this is our rich heritage. And this is our trust, actually. We're entrusted to have some appreciation for both sides of this. And if we don't, we won't carry the Dharma forward. To hold these two opposites, apparent opposites, with some grace, with some patience, with a little skill, with dedication. I think to do this, we actually do have to make practice the most important thing. The thing through which all of our efforts and activities are expressed. It may not always look like sitting zazen in a formal way. Of course it won't. And we need to lighten up so completely that we're not holding on to anything. And this skillfulness, these two sides of skillfulness and non-doing, maybe will be helpful in working with these many voices that are here with us in Sesshin. So I thought to close, here's some nice advice from a meditation teacher. I've never met this man, but I love this little essay. Someone named Dan Nussbaum. You should tell me later if you know who Dan Nussbaum is. I want to meet him someday. Some kind of meditation teacher ran into this in the great source of all dharmas, the internet. So it's some advice for us about practicing with a good spirit. called In Meditation You Have Permission. In Meditation You Have Permission. Here's what he says. You have permission to do the meditation practice of your choice or not to do it. You have permission to do the meditation practice you've been doing all along. You have permission to believe in it, or to question it, or to enjoy it, or to let it take you where it takes you. You have permission to be bored. How else will you ever get to the bottom of boredom? You have permission to try something else. You have permission to think. You have permission to worry. You have permission to wonder if you're doing it right. You have permission to wonder what doing it right means. You have permission to see yourself wondering. Did you start meditation to become a good meditator? You have permission to do it wrong. But if you have permission to do it wrong, how can you do it wrong? Think about that one. You have permission to be bad. You have permission to remember what it was like to be carefree. You have permission to doubt those memories. You have permission to get back to those memories, whether you made them up or not. You have permission to know that you make up memories. You have permission to go over German verbs. It actually says that on here. Let me look it up. You have permission to think about the different grades of motor oil. You have permission to wonder, how could this be meditation? You have permission to note bodily sensations. You have permission to do something else with bodily sensations. Love them, be suspicious of them, forbid them, give them meaning, question that meaning. You have permission to have feelings. You have permission to need someone, to worry out of habit, to fear vaguely, to feel disgust, to insist on getting things your way. You have permission to let things go on. You have permission to find yourself in unexpected mind states. You have permission to get lost. You have permission to be curious and interested. You have permission to get transfixed. You have permission to feel calm. You have permission to feel sleepy. You have permission to sleep. How else will you ever learn about waking up if you don't give yourself permission to go to sleep? You have permission to know yourself in meditation. You have permission. You have permission. You have permission. Thank you very much.